Hello, and welcome to the 2024 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, The Gifts of Christmas. The tradition of gift-giving during Christmas has deep and complex historical roots. The story of how the Magi, or three wise men, brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh to an infant Jesus is a familiar one. These offerings were not just valuable, but thoughtful and symbolic. Gold represented Jesus' kinship, frankincense, his divine nature, and myrrh, his mortality. For Christians, it's the origin story of how Christmas became associated with presents. However, the tradition of gift giving extended long before the founding of Christianity, with roots in the festivals of the ancient Romans, in particular, the festival of Saturnalia, where thanks were given to the bounty provided by the agricultural god Saturn. The festivities took place from the 17th to the 23rd of December and were celebrated with a sacrifice and a public banquet, followed by private gift giving, continued partying, and a wild atmosphere where social standings were done away with. Throughout the centuries, all cultures have created their own form of gift giving. In the 1500s, Las Posadas was originated in Mexico by Augustinian friars who wanted to celebrate extra masses and teach the native people about Catholicism. The celebration takes place over 9 days, symbolic of Mary's 9 months of pregnancy. Today, Posada celebrations occur all over Mexico and the United States. During the 1800s, gift-giving in America became popular when middle-class and wealthy Protestant families began giving gifts to their children at Christmas. This was partly driven by early forms of commercialism and consumerism, but it also served as a way to shift the focus of the sacred holiday from public partying and indulgence to home, family, and innocence. Welcome to the 2024 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, The Gifts of Christmas. I'm Terry Dorado. Let's begin with our first story, The Gifts of the Poinsettia by Pat Mora. As Carlos participates in the festivities of Las Posadas, preparing for the birth of Christ, a young Mexican boy worries about what gift he will have for baby Jesus.
¿Quién les da posada a esto?
Long ago, a boy named Carlos lived in the small Mexican town of San Bernardo. One cool evening, Carlos opened the heavy wooden door of his home and peeked out. This was the first night of Las Posadas. It was quiet. Chimney smoke curled from the roof of each adobe home. "Chico," said Carlos to his dog, "come and look at the stars. See how they twinkle? Even the sky knows the posadas begin tonight." Carlos shut the door and looked at his aunt, Nina, who was chopping chilies. Nina's hair was white. She moved slowly. Nina was Carlos's whole family, and she was enough. In this small house, Carlos and Nina danced. They played. They talked. Nina and Carlos were poor, but their house was full of love. "Love is magic," Nina would say. Carefully, Carlos put Chico's food next to the fireplace. Chico licked Carlos's face and put his paws on Carlos's shoulders. "No, Chico," said Carlos. "No time to play tonight. I can't be late for Las Posadas. Nina needs to rest these nights. I must go alone this year." Carlos combed his hair and went to Nina. She looked at him and smiled her Nina smile. "Carlos, when you are out under the stars, sing with all your heart. I will make you hot chocolate when you return, and you can tell me all you saw. See everything for me. Then, here is your candle. Outside, Carlos took a deep breath. He stood as tall as he could. He looked in the window and saw Chico and Nina warming themselves by the fire. He felt happy, knowing they would be waiting to hear about this night. Carlos joined the people gathered in front of a house that seemed to glow. "Buenas noches, buenas noches," he said. Candles flickered in all the windows. Soon, two boys arrived, carrying a tray with two small statues, Joseph and Mary riding a donkey. Doña Lola said, "Bueno, tonight, December 16, we begin our journey. Remember that we are travelers with Maria y Jose, Mary and Joseph. We seek rooms in an inn, a posada, just as they did long ago. For 9 nights, we will meet and carry these statues to the next house on our journey. Each night, we will knock at the door. We will ask for shelter and a place to rest for the night. This is a special time of preparing our hearts for Christmas, of deciding what gift each of us can offer to the baby Jesus, El Santo Niño." Doña Lola knocked on the door of the house. Carlos and the people in his town sang, "In the name of heaven, won't you give us shelter? My dear beloved wife, tonight can go no further." The family inside the house answered, "This is not an inn. Continue, sir, I plead." Carlos and the others sang, "My wife is Maria. She is the queen of heaven." The family inside the house answered, "Enter, holy pilgrims. We offer this small place." Slowly, the door of the house opened. Carlos' eyes grew wide. He saw candles and small lanterns. He saw plates of cookies, pan dulce, fruit punch, and candies. Carlos and the others knelt before El Nacimiento, the manger. "On Christmas Eve," thought Carlos, "I will go with the other children to the church. We will each place a special gift at the Nacimiento for the baby Jesus. But Nina and I have no money. What can I give that will be special?" When Carlos returned home, he told Nina and Chico about the statues of Mary and Joseph and about the songs and prayers. On the second night, Carlos told them, "Tonight it rained candy." Nina smiled. "Ah, a piñata," she said. "Oh, Nina, it was so beautiful," Carlos said softly. "It was a star of many colors hanging from the ceiling. Whack, whack, whack went the stick as one by one we tried to break the piñata. Finally, Violeta did break it. Fruit and candy, delicious candy, poured out. We all scrambled to grab some. Here, Nina. Here, Chico. I brought some for us." Then the three of them sat eating their Christmas candy. They stared into the fire, imagining the piñata swinging back and forth, back and forth. But that night, in the dark, Carlos worried about his gift for the Santo Niño. On the third night, Carlos returned carrying a small bundle. "Tonight, Nina, I saw a table heavy with sweets, as if in a dream. There were huge paper flowers and plates of desserts you like, bizcochos, the anise cookies you make, and candied fruit of every color." Carlos unwrapped his bundle and smiled at the look on Nina's face.
"Carlos, you must help me eat all this," said Nina.
"Chico will help us," said Carlos.
"Yes, even Chico liked the bizcochos and candied pumpkin from the posadas."
On the fourth night, Carlos said, "Tonight I will tell you about my favorite game at Las Posadas. The lady of the house gave us cascarones, eggshells filled with confetti. We all ran about cracking eggs on heads, but trying not to get hit. We laughed and laughed." Carlos held up one of the eggs to show Nina.
Chico thought it was more candy and jumped to bite it. The egg burst. Confetti filled the air. Nina, Carlos, and Chico all got sprinkled with bits of red, yellow, green, and blue paper. Carlos placed a soft kiss on Nina's head and said, "You have jewels in your hair, Nina."
"So do you," said Nina, laughing.
"And Chico," they said together. The next night, after Carlos told Nina and Chico about the rows and rows of papel picado cut paper fluttering above the manger, he went to bed early. Carlos was worried. "What shall I do, Chico? I can bring Nina candy and confetti, but what can I take to the baby Jesus on Christmas Eve? I want my gift to glow like a jewel." Walking home on the sixth night, Carlos was very sad. He stopped on the hilltop, and he sat on his favorite rock to stare at the stars. "I have no gift for the Santo Niño," thought Carlos. "I wish his star would drop from the sky. I would catch it, carry it home, and surprise Nina and Chico. I would take the star to the church on Christmas Eve. It would be my shining gift for the baby Jesus." But no star fell from the sky. "Look what the lady of the house gave me," said Carlos on the seventh night. He held up two farolitos, tin lanterns. "They are to make our town glow on Noche Buena, Christmas Eve. They will light the way for the Santo Niño. On Noche Buena, we will place lanterns in the trees, on roofs, around the church. And this year, Nina, we too will have our own farolitos to hang outside our door. Oh, Nina, what a night Christmas Eve will be." On the eighth night, Carlos received tamales and buñuelos. Carlos loved buñuelos, the crisp, thin cookies sparkling with sugar made for Noche Buena. At home, Carlos asked, "Nina, tomorrow, will you go with me to the church? Chico will guard our home. First, we will light our farolitos. Then we will carry our candles to the last house of the Posadas. The boys will take the statues of Joseph and Mary and place them in the Nacimiento at the church. The journey will be over." Carlos became quiet. "Carlos," said Nina, "don't forget that you and the other children will each place a small gift before the manger." Carlos said nothing. Nina knew Carlos was worried. "Jesus was poor like you, Carlos. He loved to run and play in the hills of his town, just like you do. Go out tomorrow and collect the plant that grows wild near your favorite rock. That plant can be your gift." "But Nina, I want my gift to shine," said Carlos. "I can't take a weed as a gift." "The Santo Niño will understand," said Nina. "Love makes small gifts special." Finally, it was Christmas Eve. Carlos stood in line before the manger with the other children holding his little plant. Some of the children carried presents, flowers, or small wooden toys. Carlos felt sad. He thought, "My gift is such a small gift." A tear slipped down his face and fell on his plant. Then something happened. His tear turned the leaf red, bright, bright red. Carlos looked at Nina. He looked back at the plant in his hand. Another tear fell, and another leaf turned red, bright red. Carlos looked at Nina again. She smiled. Then it was his turn to place his gift before the Nacimiento. Carlos put down his glowing red plant. It was the most beautiful gift in the church. Carlos squeezed Nina's hand. She had been right. Love is magic. Love makes small gifts special. Maria.
In our next story, we will explore the three words every parent does not want to hear on Christmas morning. Some assembly required. There is a phrase that strikes terror in the heart of any parent, especially on Christmas Eve. It's those three little words, just three, but say those words to parents and you will see fear in their eyes. They may scream, they may cry. Some will instantly turn into blubbering idiots. And what are those three little words of horror?
Some assembly required.
You see, when a toy box says,
some assembly required,
it doesn't mean that you might have to spend 10 minutes or so putting together a plastic castle complete with knights and a moat. No, it means you need a degree in architecture, an entire toolkit scaled to the castle's proportions, and the ability to read and understand 392 pages of instructions written in Sanskrit. And that's just to get the castle parts out of the box. Now, there are people, men, who believe that they don't need the instructions. No, they will run around, beat their chests, and yell, "Instructions! I don't need no stinking instructions!" Then they will dump the 1,528 castle pieces in a pile on the floor and proceed to assemble something that looks like a cross between an easy-bake oven and a Labrador retriever, but which in no way resembles a castle. Women, on the other hand, love to read instructions. We don't actually want to assemble the stupid castle, but we want to tell the man making the castle exactly how to do it. This doesn't endear us to the man who is putting the castle together. In fact, castle assembly arguments are the leading cause of divorce in this country. Occasionally, more than one man will attempt to build the castle. This is a very, very bad idea. For some reason, men see castle assembly as a challenge. They must win against the castle no matter what. And if another man steps in to help with the castle, it becomes an even bigger challenge. The first guy is no longer just battling a castle with 1,528 pieces. He's also battling his best friend, who just had to stick his nose into the castle assembly process. Soon, the battle escalates into a full-blown testosterone war, and a challenge is issued. Man 1, "I can build that castle in 2 hours." Man 2, "I can build that castle in 1 hour. Man 1, "I can build that castle in 15 minutes without once glancing at the instructions."
Build that castle!
And that is how the drawbridge ends up on the wrong side of the moat. Once the drawbridge is fixed, the men will circle the castle, thumping their chests with pride for a job well done. Unfortunately, they aren't finished. You see, no castle is complete without teeny tiny decals that have to be stuck onto the castle pieces. Some of these decals are so small they are not visible to the naked eye. You need special glasses and tweezers just to apply them. And the decals are always either too small or too large for the castle part they need to be stuck on. Even if you were lucky enough to find a castle part and decal that are perfectly sized, the decal always ends up crooked or upside down or ripped and then painstakingly pieced back together. About this time, one of the chest thumpers discovers that the decals are supposed to be put on before the castle is assembled. So now the entire castle has to be taken apart, decals put on, and then reassembled. Many men have failed at this point. They may try to block the pain by drinking large amounts of alcohol. Unfortunately, women will step in and try to help. They'll mix drinks or maybe call customer service. Neither works. For one thing, customer service is only open on weekdays from 9 to 5 when no one in the entire world is trying to assemble toys. And you should never drink and assemble. You don't even want to imagine what the castle will look like after the assembler has a few Mai Tais under his belt. So what is a parent to do? First, throw the decals away. And then, don't worry about the castle. Because once it is set up in the playroom, your kid will move the knights around and make sure the water in the moat is real. And then, he'll be bored and want to play with something else. And of course, that toy just needs a little assembly. Relax, have your hot cocoa with schnapps, and you'll feel better. "'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house I searched for the tools to hand to my spouse. Instructions were studied and we were inspired in hopes we could manage some assembly required. The children were quiet in their beds, while Dad and I faced the evening with dread. In the kitchen, two bikes, Barbie's townhouse to boot, and thanks to Grandpa, a train with a toot. We opened the boxes, my heart skipped a beat. Let no pieces be missing or parts incomplete. Too late for last minute returns or replacement. If we can't get it right, it goes down in the basement. When what to my worrying eyes should appear but 50 sheets of directions, concise but not clear, with each part numbered and every slot named, so if there was failure, only we could be blamed. More rapid than eagles, the parts they fell out. All over the floor, they were scattered about. Now bolt it, now twist it, attach it right there. Slide on the seats where the metal is bare. Hammer the shelves and nail to the stand. Honey, said hubby, you just glued my hand. And then, in a twinkling, I knew for a fact that all the toy dealers had indeed made a pact to keep parents busy on Christmas Eve night with assembly required till morning's first light. We spoke not a word, but kept bent at our work till our eyes, they went bleary, our fingers all hurt. The coffee went cold, and the night it wore thin before we attached the last rod and last pin. Then laying the tools away in the chest, we fell into bed for a well-deserved rest. But I said to my husband just before I passed out, this will be the best Christmas without any doubt. Tomorrow we'll cheer, let the holiday ring, and not have to run to the store for a thing. We did it! We did it! The toys are all set for the perfect, most perfectest Christmas, I bet. Then off to dreamland, alas, sweet repose, I gratefully went, although I suppose there's something to say for those self-deluded. I'd forgotten that batteries are never included.
You are listening to the 2024 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, The Gifts of Christmas. I'm Terry Dorado. In our next story, we will hear the modern-day classic, The Polar Express, awarded the prestigious Caldecott Medal in 1986. The Polar Express has sold more than 7 million copies, has become a classic holiday movie, and been translated into stage productions that take place across the United States during the holiday season.
Here is the Polar Express. On Christmas Eve, many years ago, I lay quietly in my bed. I did not rustle the sheets. I breathed slowly and silently. I was listening for a sound a friend had told me I'd never hear, the ringing bells of Santa's sleigh. There is no Santa, my friend had insisted, but I knew he was wrong. Late that night, I did hear sounds, though not of ringing bells. From outside came the sounds of hissing steam and squeaking metal. I looked through my window and saw a train standing perfectly still in front of my house. It was wrapped in an apron of steam. Snowflakes fell lightly around it. A conductor stood at the open door of one of the cars. He took a large pocket watch from his vest, then looked up at my window. I put on my slippers and robe. I tiptoed downstairs and out the door. "All aboard!" the conductor cried out. I ran up to him. "Well," he said, "are you coming?" "Where?" I asked. "Why, to the North Pole, of course," was his answer. "This is the Polar Express." I took his outstretched hand and he pulled me aboard. The train was filled with other children, all in their pajamas and nightgowns. We sang Christmas carols and ate candies with nugget centers and white as snow. We drank hot cocoa, thick and rich as melted chocolate bars. Outside, the lights of towns and villages flickered in the distance as the Polar Express raced northward. Soon, there were no more lights to be seen. We traveled through cold, dark forests where lean wolves roamed and white-tailed rabbits hid from our train as it thundered through the quiet wilderness. We climbed mountains so high, it seemed as if we would scrape the moon. But the Polar Express never slowed down. Faster and faster, we ran along, rolling over peaks and through valleys, like a car on a roller coaster. The mountains turned into hills, the hills to snow-covered plains. We crossed a barren desert of ice, the Great Polar Ice Cap. Lights appeared in the distance. They looked like the lights of a strange ocean liner sailing on a frozen sea. "There," said the conductor, "is the North Pole." The North Pole. It was a huge city, standing alone at the top of the world, filled with factories where every Christmas toy was made. At first, we saw no elves. "They are gathering at the center of the city," the conductor told us. "That is where Santa will give the first gift of Christmas." "Who receives the first gift?" we all asked. The conductor answered,
"He will choose one of you."
"Look," shouted one of the children, "the elves!" Outside, we saw hundreds of elves. As our train drew closer to the center of the North Pole, we slowed to a crawl. So crowded were the streets with Santa's helpers. When the Polar Express could go no farther, we stopped and the conductor led us outside. We pressed through the crowd to the edge of a large open circle. In front of us stood Santa's sleigh. The reindeer were excited. They pranced and paced, ringing the silver sleigh bells that hung from their harnesses. It was a magical sound, like nothing I'd ever heard. Across the circle, the elves moved apart and Santa Claus appeared. The elves cheered wildly. He marched over to us and, pointing to me, said,
"Let's have this fellow here."
He jumped into his sleigh. The conductor handed me up. I sat on Santa's knee and he asked,
"Now, what would you like for Christmas?"
I knew that I could have any gift I could imagine. But the thing I wanted most for Christmas was not inside Santa's giant bag. What I wanted more than anything was one silver bell from Santa's sleigh. When I asked, Santa smiled. Then he gave me a hug and told an elf to cut a bell from a reindeer's harness. The elf tossed it up to Santa. He stood, holding the bell high above him, and called out, "The first gift of Christmas!"
A clock struck midnight as the elves roared their approval. Santa handed the bell to me, and I put it in my bathrobe pocket. The conductor helped me down from the sleigh. Santa shouted out the reindeer's names and cracked his whip. His team charged forward and climbed into the air. Santa circled once above us, then disappeared in the cold, dark polar sky. As soon as we were back inside the Polar Express, the other children asked to see the bell. I reached into my pocket, but the only thing I felt was a hole. I had lost the silver bell from Santa Claus' sleigh. "Let's hurry outside and look for it," one of the children said. But the train gave a sudden lurch and started moving. We were on our way home. It broke my heart to lose the bell. When the train reached my house, I sadly left the other children. I stood at my doorway and waved goodbye. The conductor said something from the moving train, but I couldn't hear him. "What?" I yelled out. He cupped his hands around his mouth. "Merry Christmas," he shouted. The Polar Express let out a loud blast from its whistle and sped away. On Christmas morning, my little sister Sarah and I opened our presents. When it looked as if everything had been unwrapped, Sarah found one last small box behind the tree. It had my name on it. Inside was the silver bell. There was a note. "Found this on the seat of my sleigh. Fix that hole in your pocket." Signed, Mr. C. I shook the bell. It made the most beautiful sound my sister and I had ever heard. But my mother said, "Oh, that's too bad." "Yes," said my father, "it's broken." When I'd shaken the bell, my parents had not heard the sound. At one time, most of my friends could hear the bell, but as years passed, it fell silent for all of them. Even Sarah found one Christmas that she could no longer hear its sweet sound. Though I've grown old, the bell still rings for me, as it does for all who truly believe. You are listening to the 2024 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, The Gifts of Christmas. I'm Terry Dorado. Let's continue this year's special with another classic tale, The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. The Gift of the Magi is a short story by O. Henry, pen name of William Sidney Porter, and was first published in 1905. The story tells of a young husband and wife and how they deal with the challenge of buying secret Christmas gifts for each other with very little money. Now, let's listen to the ultimate gift-giving of sacrificial love with The Gift of the Magi. $1.87, that was all, and 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the slightest imputation of parsimony that such close dealings implied. Three times Della counted it, $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it, which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating.
While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also, appertaining thereunto, was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D, but whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim, her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly, she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there are two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both take a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday to dry, just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor, with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every second he passed just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached down below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again, nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still, while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket. On went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofroni. Hair goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofroni. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della.
I buy hair, said Madame. Take your hat off and let's have a sight at the looks of it.
Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame.
lifting the mass with a practiced hand.
"Give it to me quick," said Della.
Oh, in the next 2 hours, trip by on rosy wings. Forget the hash metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him, quietness and value. The description applied to both. $21 they took from her, and she hurried home with 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. "If Jim doesn't kill me," she said to herself, "before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made, and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying a little silent prayer about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I'm still pretty." The door opened and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with a peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you."
"You've cut off your hair?" asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor.
"Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?"
Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone?" he said with an air almost of idiocy.
"You needn't look for it," said Della. "It's sold, I tell you. Sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered.
she went on with sudden serious sweetness. But nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put on the chops, Jim? Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it on the table. Don't make any mistake, Dale, he said, about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that can make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first. White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper. And then an ecstatic scream of joy. And then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoise shell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers. But the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped up like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunt it all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Dale," said he, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now, suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of 2 foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that at all who give gifts, these 2 were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are wisest. Everywhere, they are wisest. They are the Magi. Let's finish this year's special with a story about how giving simple gifts and giving them with love truly symbolizes the meaning of Christmas. Here is The Last Best Gift by Katherine Umbarger.
It was my 12th Christmas, and school had finally let out for the holidays. The kids on the bus were bouncing and laughing, showing off trinkets from class parties. When we got off at our stop, though, all joy drove away with our schoolmates, leaving us in a cloud of smelly exhaust on the long, empty road. We turned toward home to walk in single-file silence, five skinny, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, look-alike kids. Bits of wood flicked as Roddy, the oldest, whittled away at a little wooden warplane. Lynn, the youngest, stretched his stride to match Roddy's footprints. I watched Lynn's sodden shoelaces flapping and frayed. Our sisters, Liz and Ellie, lagged behind as we slogged through the slush to face our first Christmas without Dad. It was 1946. My friend Quinn's dad had died in the war, and the Ladies' Society had brought special things for his family's Christmas, but not our dad, and not for our family. In a way, though, it was the end of the war that killed him. He lost his job as custodian when the Baxter Army Hospital closed. After that, between his carpentry and our little go-broke farm, Mom said he just worked too hard and worried too much. We'd all stood there after the ambulance drove away, watching the snow whip across the porch light, feeling as bleak and hollow as that endless January night. Then our own little war began. Survival. Come spring, Mom sold the farm, and we moved to 5 acres and an old one-room schoolhouse. We slept in an army tent, worked on neighboring farms, and spent every spare hour adding a kitchen and 2 bedrooms to the building. Now, the lights of our little house beckoned in the early dusk of Washington winter. As we threw open the door and stomped the slush from our feet, Mom called, "There's a surprise when your chores are done." Coming back from milking, I saw it, propped behind the house, the most enormous Christmas tree ever. We didn't question how it got there. Roddy and I wrestled it through the door. Its sharp fragrance penetrated our lungs as we nailed boards on and stood it up. Mom quietly fingered its deep green needles, which glistened from the melt of light fallen snow. Our eyes feasted on it. Its spikes scraped the ceiling, and the branches almost blocked the doors to the bedrooms. Best of all, it crowded out the gloom that had followed us home. Lynn ran in circles, whooping with delight. Ellie begged, "Can we decorate tonight?" Mom nodded, "If you can find the ornaments." Ellie grabbed her coat from the school hooks by the door and dashed out with the flashlight, Lynn close behind. "Try the big shed," Mom called, "and tie those shoes, Lynn." The old farmhouse had been double the size of this little place, and we hadn't gotten rid of a thing. The 2 sheds and the old tent were pretty jam-packed, and the house, with its abundance of cubbyholes, was crammed. Everything was there, somewhere, but we could never find what we wanted when we needed it, except for Dad's old carpentry tools, which I'd carefully oiled and hung in the smaller shed. I had a few tools of my own, one of which I'd found on the road last summer, a beautiful screwdriver with an oversized handle of inlaid wood. Dad would have liked it. His tools were just about all he'd left to us, those and 3 inrolls of paper he'd brought home way back when he was the custodian at Sunset McKee Sales Book Company. Dad was supposed to toss them into the furnace to heat the building, but he just couldn't see burning a thing before its best use was realized. They stood, propped in the corner of the living room, 2 rolls of tissue paper and 1 heavier, good enough to draw on. I think that, until that moment, we'd been saving them as if holding on to a piece of Dad himself.
Liz dragged out the heavy one. Let's make a banner, Rich. We cut a piece from the roll and smoothed it across the floor. As Liz poked through the stubs, she asked Mom, Did you finish your Christmas sweater?
Mm-hmm.
Mom smiled as she rocked and nodded. Somebody had given her the yarn, and she'd been knitting every night for a month. We kids tried not to bicker and helped each other with homework so as not to interrupt her. With Mom's new job, on top of everything else, that Christmas sweater was the first thing she'd done just for herself since Dad had died. Roddy joined the little kids in hunting for the decorations, and then we unpacked our memories. The tin carousel that turned in the heat of its candles, the old glass ornaments from Norway, the wooden creche Dad had carved for us kids to paint, faded paper Santas from each child's kindergarten, and miles of crinkled tinsel and tangled lights. It was the next day, Christmas Eve, before the last piece of tinsel went on. We fed more wood to the shiny porcelain heat-a-later, and the room took on a glow all its own. Let's eat supper by the tree, Liz suggested. Like a picnic, Ellie chimed in. And we did. Hot dogs, macaroni, and green beans, with hard-boiled eggs from our own chickens, milk from our own cow, and ginger cookies we had all helped drizzle sugar frosting on. It took forever for me to fall asleep. Roddy next to me didn't move a muscle after pulling up the quilts, but I could tell by his breathing that he was awake too. Lynn rearranged the covers several times, but none of us spoke. Away from the warmth of the big room, the cold emptiness of Dad's absence enveloped us. He should have been tucking us in and closing the door with a traditional Christmas admonition. You stay out of Santa's way now, and no peeking. Nobody had even mentioned hanging stockings. We all knew Mom could afford only one small present for each of us. We all knew, but we weren't prepared for just how small the pile of presents would appear under that great huge tree when we crept out of our bedrooms in the morning. The puddle under Mom's boots told us she'd already done our chores. Ellie, Liz, Lynn, and I scrunched on the couch and sat straight as pokers with our hands folded. The bentwood rocker creaked as Mom lowered herself into it. She pulled the hem of Dad's old blue corduroy robe around her ankles. I thought I saw tears in her eyes, but I wasn't sure. "I'll stoke the fire again," Roddy said. I think he was more intent on prolonging the gift opening than warming the room. We all waited, trying not to stare at the base of the tree. I wished we kids hadn't drawn names. Lynn's feet began to bounce in impatience. "Let Rich open my present first," he said, as Roddy took his place in the olive-green overstuffed chair, Dad's chair. Everybody said Lynn looked the most like Dad, but Roddy turned to Lynn with Dad's eyes and a Dad's tone. "Hold your horses, sonny." Dad had always started at the bottom of the pile, so the first gift would be a surprise. But this pile was a single layer. So Roddy did the next best thing. He stirred them around with his hand to choose the first at random. "Let's see here." He turned the tag to read it. For each gift, he stirred and drew and slowly read the tag. But no matter how he tried to make it last, those presents were opened in no time at all, and we sat, each with two gifts in our hands. I held a paper ornament Lynn had made at school, and a little pickup truck, real metal, with a red cab and a green box. Liz got up first. She placed her gifts on her spot. "Don't anybody sit on these," and knelt to look under the couch. Her bathrobe sleeve jammed way up, and she stretched her arm underneath. I couldn't tell what she pulled out, even though she was mere feet from me. Ellie, who had a better view, got a funny look on her face. Then she, too, scooted off the cushion and let her presence behind to dig through the pile of mittens by the hooks. Then Liz hauled one of Dad's old tissue paper rolls into the girl's room. Suddenly, it must have been magic because I don't know how we knew. We were all looking for things under furniture, behind boxes, and in cubbyholes, secreting what we found into the pockets and folds of our robes. The second giant roll of tissue paper went to our bedroom, and scissors and tape were passed back and forth as we hid what we were wrapping from the others. With new gifts piled under the tree, we took our places again, not quite so poker straight this time, and Roddy handed them around. I unwrapped my long-lost penny whistle. Ellie hugged her missing baby doll. Mom had a matched pair of gloves again. We kept it up all morning. We got dressed and searched the tent and shed, finding things, wrapping them, ripping them open again. We threw the paper every which way, bounced lost balls, tried on missing hats, played jacks. We got sillier and sillier. We even sneaked into each other's drawers and wrapped things that hadn't been lost at all. Somewhere in there, Mom put cranberries on to boil and a chicken in the oven. The aroma rose, filling the house. So did the mountain of crumpled tissue paper. We had to wade through it to get to the kitchen when she called us to eat, while the last set of gifts waited under the tree. After dinner, I never felt so full, not just of food, but of fun, of pure joy and anticipation. I could hardly wait for the others to open what I had for them. This last pile had more gifts than all the others. Roddy drew the nearest first and handed it to me. It was small but heavy. The scrawl read, "Too rich," from Roddy. My heart quickened, but I opened it slowly. "Your best knife," I whispered. I was afraid I might cry. The most magnificent magic had just begun, for this time we had each sought gifts for the others from among our own treasures. My heart about burst watching Roddy open my screwdriver with the inlaid handle. Liz and Ellie ended up with each other's favorite dolls. I don't remember it all, but Lynn got two from everybody because we each gave him our shoelaces. As we sat amidst our bounty, eating baby Jesus's birthday cake, Liz asked, "Why aren't you wearing your new sweater, Mom? Your new Christmas sweater?" Mom's eyes sparkled as she raised her eyebrows and said, "Maybe we're all wearing it. Maybe the whole room is wearing it." She rocked back and forth in the old bentwood rocker, her face glowing in the light of the splendid tree. Roddy's jaw dropped. You could hear him suck in his breath. "What?" said Liz. "She traded it," Roddy said quietly, "for the tree." All eyes turned to Mom. "I couldn't have done it without all of you," Mom said. "Don't you remember being extra good so that I could finish on time?" This time, she didn't stop the tears in her eyes as we gathered around, hugging her all at once. And Dad was right there with us, in Lynn's face and Roddy's eyes, in the old blue robe, in the traditions and ornaments, and in that grand mound of tissue paper that had wrapped our Christmas and taught us the best use of things. We hugged Mom until her chair almost rocked right over. Then we jumped and played in the paper like a pile of leaves. Finally, handfuls at a time, we wadded it up tight and tossed it into the shiny porcelain heater, watching the flames and feeling the warmth, one wad at a time, until they were gone. It was my father's last best gift.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the 2024 Sight into Sound Christmas special, The Gifts of Christmas. The 2024 Sight into Sound Christmas special, The Gifts of Christmas, was a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Your producer was Jim Martinez. On behalf of all the staff and volunteers at Sight into Sound Radio, we would like to wish all of you a very Merry Christmas. I'm Terry Dorado.